Hello, welcome back, and welcome to our panel on exploring effective climate solutions. I'm your moderator, Tony Cerna, and one of my jobs as CCL Strategy Director is to try to look around the curve at what is coming next and help prepare our organization for where we need to be 1, 2, or even 5 years from now. In an always volatile and changing political environment, that is no easy task, and it is great to get the advice and wisdom of experts from across the climate movement. Today we have with us three amazing experts, and I can't wait to hear from them. We have Dr. Marilyn Brown, who is a Regents Professor in the School of Public Policy at Georgia Institute of Technology, where she created and co-leads the Climate and Energy Policy Lab. She served on the U.S. Department of Energy Electricity Advisory Committee, has written 9 books on the clean energy transition, and is a member of the National Academy of Sciences. Her research focuses on the design and modeling of energy markets and carbon reduction policies and programs, highlighting opportunities on the consumer side of the electric meter. We also have Ellie Johnson, who leads Climate Interactive's global climate and energy efforts. She has built up Climate Interactive's engagement programs to extend to thousands worldwide, from top journalists to leading decision makers to school children. Ellie has been a speaker at UN meetings, the White House, the African Union, and many universities, and her work has been cited in publications like the New York Times, Associated Press, and Washington Post. She's the founder of several grassroots climate change efforts and advises campaign strategy and network development for organizations. We also have Dr. Jennifer Marlin, who is a research scientist and lecturer at the Yale School of the Environment and the Yale Program on Climate Change Communication, YPCCC, National Academy of Engineering. Dr. Marlin uses a range of methods, e.g. surveys, experiments, modeling to understand public perceptions of and responses to environmental change, particularly relating to climate and extreme weather events. Examples of her recent projects include the Yale Climate Opinion Maps, which we all know and love. Her research has been published in diverse disciplinary and interdisciplinary journals, including Nature Geoscience, Nature Climate Change, and the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Okay, we're gonna start by giving each of them a few minutes to present, and then we'll have time for questions. Please use Zoom's Q&A feature to suggest questions you'd like me to ask. Thank you, each of you, so much. And we'll start with Dr. Brown. So Dr. Brown, feel free to take it away.
All right. Thank you very much, Tony. I appreciate your introductory remarks on what I've accomplished. Mm-hmm. My mother would appreciate them also, and my father would believe them. I wanted to introduce in my 5 minutes Citizens Climate Lobby group here to the Drawdown Georgia project, which has been going on for about 3 years in the state of Georgia, a state where the state level leadership for climate action has been limited, and therefore a grassroots based movement has erupted to fill the void. And it's been a science-based systematic approach to determining solutions that fit the state of Georgia. Now, I guess I need to go and share my my screen. So let me go ahead and do that. Our project began by identifying promising climate solutions that could significantly address Georgia's net carbon emissions by 2030. We started with the results of the Project Drawdown, which is a global assessment to identify the top 100 climate solutions over the next half century. And that, you might remember, was summarized in a great New York Times bestseller edited by Paul Hawken called Drawdown. So Project Drawdown provided the beginnings of a set of solutions and a roadmap for Georgia, but was not an acceptable localized roadmap for Georgia, because there are many solutions that might work nationally and internationally, but not, in fact, for the state of Georgia. So we went about a highly engaging process by which we took those 100 global solutions and put them through a series of filters. So we started off asking, well, is the solution relevant in Georgia? For instance, tropical rainforest, one of the top solutions for Project Drawdown, was not. Is the technology Is the solution technology and market ready to scale by 2030? We're looking at the next decade, not the mid-century mark of Project Drawdown. And for instance, fusion fell short here. Is there sufficient local experience and available data in the state of Georgia? Well, an example here would be tidal energy. No such experience and no data. We didn't think that it could achieve a high impact in that situation. Then fourth, can the solution deliver a 1 million ton CO2 reduction annually by the year 2030? That was not a random number. We went about benchmarking the carbon footprint of the state of Georgia and concluded that in the year 2020, the state was responsible for a net emissions of 122 million tons of CO2. So 1 million tons makes it about a 1% solution. And we didn't want to spend our time on tiny solutions. It seemed like a reasonable threshold. Is it cost competitive with other solutions? So in each instance, we asked that question. In the case, for instance, of wind energy, it failed to meet that competitive test, at least in this first and important decade. So finally, along with these five questions, we asked, is there any other beyond carbon impact that would cause us to put this solution at the top or maybe the bottom of the list? And those other impacts included things like, is there an equity issue? Is there a jobs creation or destruction issue? Is there an impact on public health? And how might this solution affect the broader environment? So the research team of universities across Georgia engaged with the public, polled opinions. We worked with our stakeholders throughout the process, and we reported preliminary results. We evaluated feedback and resulted in this list of our top 20 solutions for the state of Georgia. So what I'm describing is a way by which we've taken a very broad and generic a set of solutions down to one that's tailor-made for the state of Georgia. And the same process could be used to tailor-make a set of solutions for a town, a county, a region. All of this is published in this case in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. So this set of 20 solutions spans all of the sectors of the economy. We do take into account the ability of natural solutions to absorb CO2. So this is a emissions and absorption net emissions assessment. Many of these solutions, as you look through them, are at the discretion of consumers, such as recycling, a plant-rich diet. These are solutions that the public can adopt. Perhaps they need more information. Maybe they need a little bit of incentivization, but they don't need the business sector necessarily to produce a new product. Then there are those that do require the action of businesses. For instance, in order to build out our charging infrastructure in the state of Georgia, we need to engage business. Then those that require government assistance and regulation. An example there might be rooftop solar, for which we need net metering in the state of Georgia. Or transit, for which we need funds. And I'm pleased to say that the infrastructure bill that's just been passed by Congress addresses many of these 20, but a crosswalk across these 20 and all that's in the bill shows a few things are omitted. It's an infrastructure bill. It doesn't define forests as infrastructure, or it doesn't define the coast as infrastructure. So those things are not there. But many things are, and so really pleased with the progress that was made last week in Washington. Well, with these 20 solutions, we proceeded to examine how far they could take the state of Georgia if they were implemented as a package. We looked at their interactions. You know, there's no point in having a lot of electric vehicles if your grid is dirty. And if you have a very clean grid, then retrofitting is not as impactful in terms of climate change. So in 2005, the state of Georgia had a net carbon footprint of about 157 million tons. So you can see we've made a lot of progress. 128 in 2017, 122 in 2020. We don't see that the forecast is going to be without additional action, going to be reduced. However, with these 20 solutions, we could bring the state's emissions down to 79, which would be a 50% reduction from the 2005 emissions. So yay, we have planned to meet the carbon commitment of the Paris Accord. So now we're moving to a number of engagement and activation tasks. One of them is to track greenhouse gas emissions by county, by month. We're trying to bring this data to the local level, make it even more local, not just the state, but the county in which you're located, the metropolitan region and the micropolitan region as well. This makes, you can't manage what you can't measure. So we're focusing on that. The second is that we're engaging business. So we have the first statewide climate compact of businesses, certainly in Georgia and perhaps across the country. It was announced in October, October 18th. We have Coca-Cola, Delta, Norfolk Southern, 16 big and several small companies have agreed to release information about their emissions, to track them, to attempt to meet a net carbon zero goal by mid-century for the state of Georgia, to work together to become a community of like-minded businesses that will assist each other and that we as a university team can assist as well. And then we're also doing some more planning and tracking of solution activation. One of my favorite projects at the moment is a game. We're developing a climate solutions game. It'll be released early next year so people can have fun seeing what they know about these solutions and competing against each other in teams. So really pleased to have had a chance to share this with you. I look forward to our panel. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Brown. And if you could stop sharing, that'd be great so that we can move on to Ellie Johnson from Climate Interactive. Take it away, Ellie.
Great. It's a pleasure to be with you all. It's been so wonderful to hear from everyone so far at this conference and excited about what's to come. Let me just get my screen going here. And while I'm doing that, though, let me explain who I am. As Tony indicated at the beginning, I'm Climate Interactive's climate and energy lead. And so I've really been one of the developers of this simulation tool that I know many of you all have heard of called En-ROADS. It's a global climate solution simulator. But before I even get to En-ROADS, on my mind today, just to acknowledge it, is COP26. I got myself started in climate work many, many years ago, and have been to 7 of these climate negotiations. So the last 2 weeks, I have been getting up early and staying up late, just reading through everything that's going on at COP26. And as Danny was speaking just before this session, I flipped open the webcast and you could see Huddle, John Kerry and other world leaders there in huddles trying to come up with that final agreement of what the text is gonna look like. So. It's a little bit nail biting right now, but it's also just good to be in community with so many people that are working on this challenge. And my work at the climate negotiations and throughout just really inspires me to just see how many people are incredibly motivated and working on this. The angle that I approach it with is climate models, climate simulation tools, En-ROADS. And so I'm going to share my PowerPoint here, share. Hopefully you all can see it as I go full screen here. All right, So En-ROADS, as many of you all know, it's a climate simulation model used to test different climate solutions and create scenarios for the future. It's global. We, my team at Climate Interactive, along with a team at the MIT Sloan School of Management's Sustainability Initiative, has built the tool, and we've really designed it so that anyone can use it. There are lots of amazing climate models out there that largely reside within academic institutions and require kind of expert level expertise to use. We wanted to create something that synthesizes the best available science, makes it accessible for people to use, and gives people a way that they can engage, have conversations about climate solutions that are grounded in science in a dynamic way, in a way that kind of opens people's possibilities to different thinking. And so the way we do that is with En-ROADS. It's really designed to improve decision maker and citizen understanding of energy, land, and climate dynamics as a means to effective action. And I know this is 100% what so many of you all are up to within your chapters and the work you're doing. And what we do with En-ROADS is, so we've built the climate simulator itself, and then we have a number of different ways of engaging people with it through workshops, which are done from anywhere to 500 to thousands of you all engaging, asking questions, co-creating a scenario for what works to address climate globally. Then we also have, Dr. Brown mentioned a role-playing game that they're developing in Georgia. We also have a game. So we have a global climate action simulation game that's been a really amazing way in which to bring people into the conversation about climate solutions, even if they're not thinking about it at all. And that's a fun option. And then of course, through one-on-one conversations. I don't know how many times I've sat down with somebody who's just like, okay, so you work on climate. What does that actually mean? Like, what do we really need to do on climate? And that's where En-ROADS can really shine to just kind of chart out different pathways. And then we also have curriculum resources for teachers, guided assignment, and that kind of thing. One thing that I know many of you all are part of, we have over dozens and dozens of you all as CCL volunteers. I think there's at least 70 of you all that are En-ROADS Climate Ambassador. Big shout out to anybody out there listening in who has facilitated an event with En-ROADS or is an En-ROADS Climate Ambassador. It's so great to have seen this partnership flourish where so many people have found ways in which to find a nice synergy between using En-ROADS and your advocacy work with Citizens Climate Lobby. And we can explore that more there. Well, into the breakout session in the next period, we can dive deeper and look at some of those different efforts. But here, let me just very quickly show you what I'm even talking about. Let's change my sharing, and I'm going to show you. So here we're looking at En-ROADS itself. So on the left, we have a graph, 2000 to 2100 of all of these different types of energy sources across the world that meet our energy demand. Then on the right, we have global greenhouse gas emissions. If we don't take any further action from what we're doing today, that leads to 3.6 degrees. Now, I know the topic that's on many of your minds is the carbon pricing, like what, and how do we model that? And how do we look at that within a tool like this? So I'll just show you all really quickly. I know some of you all know this, but within En-ROADS, you can test all kinds of things. So and then we can see the response in real time. But I did want to just say, if you want to test the Energy Innovation Act, we can look at it by saying, okay, well, what if we had, you know, a $15 ton carbon price starting out in the year 2021, and that would start immediately at that price. And then we have to do some math to map onto the policy that you all are advocating for to make it fit within En-ROADS. But the way we figured it out is that this reaches $850 per ton. And that it would take 58 years to achieve that. And that then we have to set this setting to be 2021. And so there you can see a rough estimation of what if the whole world adopted the EICDA. And there's some other nuances we can get into, about it, but I did just want to show you all that as just one kind of example of how we can use a tool like En-ROADS to start and engage people with a conversation about climate. And I'll stop there, and we can go into other things as we get to them.
Hey, thank you, Ellie. And everyone, don't go off to the En-ROADS website right this minute. Wait until a little bit later. Wait till the end of the conference, but then check it out. Okay, take it away, Dr. Marlin.
Thank you so much. It is tempting to go off to that site now. I'm very excited and honored to be here with you all. And I have already learned so much today. So I want to share some of the research from the Yale Program on Climate Change Communication. And I'm going to share my screen now, hopefully to do that. Let's see. So our work at the YPCCC is based on large nationally representative surveys. And are you looking at the Six Americas
chart
now?
Yes.
Okay, great. So one of the most, I'm just going to dive in and make the most of this time to share our research. So these large surveys have allowed us to take a very unique view of the American public to try to understand what the public is thinking about climate change, because it is more complicated than just what Democrats and what Republicans think. And certainly the whole public doesn't think the same thing. So what we have found is that there are six different groups, and many of you know this and are familiar with the Six Americas, but you might be a bit surprised to see the numbers change a little bit. In the screen I'm sharing right now, because in our latest research, we have found that the alarmed, who are people who are most concerned about climate change, who are most motivated to take action, are now 33% of the American public. And the concerned group is 25%. So these are folks who are also very worried about the problem, and they're motivated to take action, but they don't see the urgency. And so they clearly haven't played with En-ROADS, because they would see how our decisions that we make today have enormous consequences for the future. 17% are what you can think of as fence sitters. 5% don't really track the issue at all, don't have much information about it. 10% are doubtful that the earth is even warming. They think it may be cooling, and if it's warming, it's due to something other than human activities. And 9%, only 9% are truly dismissive. And so this is how the public breaks down. And on a national level, at least, it varies, of course, from state to state and city to city. But the point is, we all have different views, and we all bring different views to this topic. And so what I want to do is show you first how this has changed over time. And what we find is that the people in the alarmed and concerned groups are growing. Actually, the alarmed in particular is growing, and it's up 22 points since 2015. So concern about the issue is truly soaring at this point. And if I showed you the previous 5 years, you'd see that the levels were quite stable prior to that. So we're in a period of tremendous change, actually, in terms of public opinion on this. And the group that is growing the most, the alarmed, is most interested in solutions. And so when we talk to our friends and family, the question that many of us are increasingly getting is, you know, what can we do to solve this? What are the policies? Which policies are going to work? You know, how can we fix this? And so what I've been thinking about, and the approach we've been taking now, is to try to understand and communicate how our system, at least in the US, kind of works together. Where can we intervene in the system to affect change? And this is just some conceptual diagrams to help relate some of the pieces. Because if it was really just about the numbers, we would be getting much more action right now than we are. We'd be getting swift, dramatic action from all levels of government, from the private sector, and on, because 58% of us are alarmed or concerned and strongly support action. 75% if you include the cautious. So overwhelming majorities, in fact, of the public, pretty much in every state, want more action than we're getting. But of course, it's not just about the numbers of people, it's about the number of dollars and political power and so on. And so examples of the weight that are on the other side of this sort of system are, you know, fossil fuel companies and their interests, Republican leadership, banks like JP Morgan Chase, which has invested $300 billion in fossil fuels since the Paris Agreement was signed in 2015. And of course, a lot of system inertia, because my laptop and my home and many of our cars are still running on fossil fuels, of course. And then there's weight on the other side of this balance, right? We have activists and advocates and all of you and fight, you know, fighting for stronger policies. We have international pressure. We have some corporations taking significant action, cultural change more broadly. These are just examples of places where we can intervene in the system. But there is also this sort of structural bias that is built in or baked into the system. And I'm showing this with this fulcrum underneath the balance beam here. Structural biases are things like the voting barriers, fossil fuel subsidies, electoral college, gerrymandering, and other sort of systemic problems. Of course, there's action on the other side that could be taken to push that fulcrum back to the middle. At things like the Freedom to Vote Act, or, you know, removing the Senate filibuster. And so these are all different ways that we can intervene in the system. And it's important to remember how these are all interrelated. And I don't know if the balance should actually be flat right now or which way it's tilted more, but hopefully this helps you see some of the linkages and how much momentum we have at the moment to take advantage of. And I just want to leave you with a little bit more of our survey data, recent results just showing that there actually are many places where we do agree across political party lines, especially in regard to things like tax incentives or rebates to homeowners, landlords, and businesses to make existing buildings more energy efficient, for example. So we think about Democrats and Republicans being opposed, and even thinking about the Six Americas. But in fact, when you look at some of these policies, also energy efficiency standards for new buildings and appliances, providing federal funding to put solar panels on the roofs of public schools, majorities in all of these cases, majorities of conservative Republicans even support those policies. It's not until you start talking about, you know, requiring by 2030 all new cars and trucks sold in the US to be electric vehicles, which we actually need to happen, then you start seeing resistance. But the point is that we often tend to overestimate some of the political polarization. And there actually are many areas where more of us agree. So I'll leave it there. If you want to sign up for research alerts from the program, you can text us there. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Marlin. Thank you, Ellie Johnson. And thank you to Marilyn Brown as well. Thank you to all of our panelists. And I'm going to go to questions. So if you have questions for our panelists, you can put them in the Q&A. But I've got a few myself. The first one that I would like to just ask of all of you, if anyone, any of you would like to throw in an answer of just like, you know, the budget reconciliation bill is still in negotiation, so we don't know what the final product there is. But I'm just wondering, what do you think is going to be the most important thing to focus on next? Do you have any sense of where the climate movement is going to be going, or what you know, the key strategies are going to be, or policy objectives might be in the coming years? And I don't expect you to have the perfect answer to this, but I'm just sort of curious what your sense of things is. Anyone want to jump in?
I'll just say briefly that I think an area where there's a lot of room for improvement and growth is finance. And for example, requiring disclosure of climate risk by companies and really paying closer attention to the flow of money and investment. So investing in, investing in the solution instead of in the problem.
Great, great. And Ellie?
Yeah, so the reconciliation bill has a long list of different things like climate related programs. And on my mind is implementation. Mm-hmm. We work really hard to get things passed, and we're like, yay, if we can get it, you know, fingers crossed. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, we're going to have to make sure that the access to those financial resources, the access to those programs implemented well. So we actually then result in those greenhouse gas reductions that we know are so desperately needed. And so we can't, you know, we're going to want to let our foot off the gas pedal if we get this bill passed. But like so many things, we're going to have to figure out what that looks like, state levels, local levels. What are the businesses that need to be built around that? And that critical piece, and what, and then also what was missing from it that we didn't see in the run up.
Okay. And implemented well in terms of the equity and inclusion, of course, so that our overburdened and under-resourced communities get their fair share. Everyone's got to have a stake in this and get the benefits. Thank you. Thank you. All were consistent with that message.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Dr. Brown. So I have some questions specifically for each of you. So Dr. Marlin, you mentioned that there is some polarization on climate. How bad is it, and what can we do to improve that situation?
there doesn't appear to be as much polarization these days about whether there's a changing climate. So that's great. Check that one off. That's taken a long time. But there is a lot of polarization over the cost of dealing with it and the benefits that would arise. I've had a debate last week that was reported in the Wall Street Journal with a couple of economists, one of which said that it's not going to generate jobs. And anyway, jobs generation is bad. It's a cost. There's just so much disagreement over what we can do. I think that we have a double dividend situation. So much can be done that will benefit us all, often reducing the cost of doing business or the cost of your own utility bill, while at the same time tackling the climate. So I'm a real optimist on costs.
Great, thank you. And Jennifer, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, just that I think the polarization among the public in many ways is much less than it is in Congress. I guess that's quite obvious, actually. But it's important to remember when we're talking to our family and friends, because a lot of times the perception of that polarization is greater than the reality. And that perception prevents us from even talking about it. And talking about it seems like a small thing, but those little conversations that you have with your family and friends lead to cascading effects, and they're really important to have. And my suggestion, if you want to have more of them, is to maybe not start with the doubtful and dismissive groups in your life, but start with those who you know share your views, because we can learn a lot from each other. For example, on days like today, that can change our behavior in a big way and change the way we think about the actions and efforts that we're making.
Great. And Ellie, a specific question for you. So you've used this tool with a variety of different audiences across the political spectrum. What seems to resonate across that spectrum? What do you find people on both the right and the left support?
Yeah, well, broadly, we all have this, we hold close this idea of innovation. So new technology development, you know, this is like universally, we wanna see new technologies developed. We wanna invest in research and development. And so what that looks like then pans out. So I've heard tons of things, you know, people, there's a lot of questions these days about energy storage, things like hydrogen and batteries that like people are just very curious about, saying, I'm hearing about this. There's a lot of potential there for new businesses and that kind of thing. Actually, last week, there were a small handful of Republican senators that put forward a plan that said, here's our plan to address climate. It was Senator Sullivan, Senator Kramer, Senator Lummis. And we did an analysis of that using En-ROADS. And we said, okay, let's look at what their plan includes. And I was looking back at it today and thinking about what's also in the budget reconciliation bill. And it's really interesting to see where there's some really nice overlaps. You know, renewable energy, very widely supported, both in that Republican Senate plan and in the Democrats' plans right now. Big support for that, figuring out how do we drive American company business development, entrepreneurship in that sphere. The other thing that was kind of interesting to me that is not on my mind as much, but I saw come up in both plans, was around mine remediation and oil and gas well capping. So these things, if left unattended, can be sources of methane emissions. And methane emissions in general has been getting a lot more traction. And you see bipartisan support as well for figuring out how do we address methane.
Great. Thank you. Thank you. And Dr. Brown, so your work in Georgia, which is a very purple state with a very conservative state government, how did state and local government respond to the program that Drawdown Georgia put together? Okay, well, I will go on to there you are, Dr. Brown.
Yep, sorry about that. I think I heard your question, and you're asking how did the state legislature or policymakers respond to our results so far and our recommendations? Exactly. I mean, it's quite a spectrum of responses from such support that we've been able to commit all of this to credible science-based documentation of the opportunities to criticisms that it's all wishful thinking. So I like to have the numbers there to be able to refute the pessimism and skeptics and ask for, you know, comparably well-based and documented, grounded rebuttals, because we've done our due diligence. Anyway, it's varied. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Thank you. And a question for Dr. Jennifer Marlin. So, you know, you said there's a growing number in the alarmed category, but how do we, you know, what moves people from awareness and alarm to actually becoming activists themselves? Do you have any sense of, like, how do we help move people to that ladder where they're actually engaged?
Well, there is a natural movement that's happening right now already. All of the other groups except for the dismissives are changing and increasing. The dismissive group, which is still only 8 or 9%, is very small. So people are naturally moving up, and we don't know exactly what is causing that. But there are a lot of good candidates out there, including uncontrollable wildfires, heat waves, flooding. I mean, the natural disasters, they're not the human-made disasters in part, are definitely changing people's minds. But there's also a change in the political discourse, I think. We don't have someone in the White House calling it a hoax or really denying it. There's there's more acceptance of the reality, as Dr. Brown was saying, and the conversation has really changed towards debate over solutions. I think continuing, keep doing what you're doing, have more of those conversations, highlight those solutions, because people still know comparatively little. Only a third of Americans, and this is in every state, talk about it with their family and friends, even, you know, somewhat occasionally. And still only 25% of Americans say they hear about it in the media at least once a week, only 25%. So we are a unique group here, and we need to spread that information, because other folks are not listening to it and hearing any of this information. So it's critical to just keep talking about it. Yeah.
I'd like to pile on for a minute. There's also such uncertainty and disagreement about what the change in climate is costing us. I have still heard pushback that, it's still going to be valuable for some portions of the world, and the costs are not so great that we really need to take them seriously. So there's that to deal with. And there's also, in my polling of citizens across the state of Georgia, there really is a great deal of uncertainty about the solutions, how to buy them, what they mean, what they cost, whether or not they're a good investment. So there is a lot of education still to be done. I think that the Yale Communications has documented that too, but solution-specific education.
Yes, definitely. There is definitely more work for us to do, but it's very hopeful to see the work that each of you are doing. I appreciate so much you spending this time with us today. And for those of you staying for the rest of the conference today, you have 10 minutes for a break. And to join a breakout session that starts at 3:05 p.m. Eastern Time or 12:05 p.m. Pacific, go to ccclusa.org/program to see the 7 breakout session choices. And you can join a session by clicking the Join via Zoom button next to the session you want to attend. And so thank you so much, Dr. Merlin, Ellie Johnson, Dr. Brown, for being here with us today. And thank you, everyone, to the 2,000 people who have joined us on this conference. And we will see you in those breakout sessions in 10 minutes.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Citizens Climate Lobby's training program. You can tune into more episodes anywhere podcasts are available. Inspired by what you heard today? Join Citizens Climate Lobby to advocate for bipartisan climate solutions. Go to community.citizensclimate.org to find more trainings, resources, your local chapter, national action teams, discussion forums, and more. Be sure to like our Facebook page and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Citizens Climate. We also invite all of our listeners to subscribe to our YouTube channel for more inspiration. And together, we are creating the political will for a livable world.